This is Audible.
Scholastic Audio presents The Scorpio Races by Maggie Steve Otter. Read by Steve West as Sean and Fiona Hardingham as Puck. Prologue. 9 years earlier. Sean. It is the first day of November, and so, today, someone will die. Even under the brightest sun, the frigid autumn sea is all the colours of the night, dark blue and black and brown. I watch the ever-changing patterns in the sand as it's pummeled by countless hooves. They run the horses on the beach, a pale road between the black water and the chalk cliffs. It is never safe, but it's never so dangerous as today, race day. This time of year, I live and breathe the beach. My cheeks feel raw with the wind throwing sand against them. My thighs sting from the friction of the saddle. My arms ache from holding up 2,000 pounds of horse. I have forgotten what it is like to be warm, and what a full night's sleep feels like, and what my name sounds like spoken instead of shouted across yards of sand. I am so, so alive. As I head down to the cliffs with my father, one of the race officials stops me. He says,
"Sean Kendrick, you are 10 years old. You haven't discovered it yet, but there are more interesting ways to die than on this beach."
My father doubles back and takes the official's upper arm as if the man were a restless horse. They share a brief exchange about age restrictions during the race. My father wins.
"If your son is killed," the official says, "the only fault is yours."
My father doesn't even answer him, just leads his Ishka stallion away. On the way down to the water, we're jostled and pushed by men and by horses. I slide beneath one horse as it rears up, its rider jerked at the end of the lead. Unharmed, I find myself facing the sea, surrounded on all sides by the Kapil Ishka, the water horses. They are every color of the pebbles on the beach: black, red, golden, white, ivory, gray, blue. Men hang the bridles with red tassels and daisies to lessen the danger of the dark November sea, but I wouldn't trust a handful of petals to save my life. Last year, a water horse trailing flowers and bells tore a man's arm half from his body. These are not ordinary horses. Drape them with charms, hide them from the sea, but today, on the beach, do not turn your back. Some of the horses have lathered. Froth drips down their lips and chests, looking like seafoam, hiding the teeth that will tear into men later. They are beautiful and deadly, loving us and hating us. My father sends me off to get his saddlecloth and armband from another set of officials. The color of the cloth is meant to allow the spectators far up on the cliffs to identify my father, but in his case, they won't need it, not with his stallion's brilliant red coat.
"Ah, Kendrick,"
the officials say, which is both my father's name and mine.
"It'll be a red cloth for him."
As I return to my father, I am hailed by a rider.
"Ho, Sean Kendrick!"
He's diminutive and wiry, his face carved out of rock.
"Fine day for it."
I am honored to be greeted like an adult, like I belong here. We nod to each other before he turns back to his horse to finish saddling up. His small racing saddle is hand-tooled, and as he lifts the flap to give the girth a final tug, I see words burned into the leather. "Our dead drink the sea." My heart is jerking in my chest as I hand the cloth to my father. He seems unsettled as well, and I wish I was riding, not him. Myself, I am sure of. The red Ishka stallion is restless and snorting, ears pricked, eager. He's very hot today. You will be fast. Fast and difficult to hold. My father gives me the reins so that he can saddle the water horse with the red cloth. I lick my teeth. They taste like salt. And watch my father tie the matching armband around his upper arm. Every year I have watched him, and every year he has tied it with a steady hand, but not this year. His fingers are clumsy, and I know he is afraid of the red stallion. I have ridden him, this Capel. On his back, the wind beating me, the ground jarring me, the sea spraying our legs, we never tire. I lean close to the stallion's ear, and trace a counterclockwise circle above his eye as I whisper into his soft ear.
Sean!
My father snaps, and the Capel's head jerks up quickly enough that his skull nearly strikes mine.
What are you doing with your face next to his today? Does he not look hungry to you? Do you think you'd look fine with half a face?
But I just look at the stallion's square pupil, and he looks back. His head turned slightly away from me. I hope he's remembering what I told him. Do not eat my father. My father makes a noise in his throat and says,
I think you should go up now. Come here and...
He slaps my shoulder before mounting up. He is small and dark on the back of the red stallion. Already his hands work ceaselessly on the reins to keep the horse in place. The motion twists the bit in the horse's mouth. I watch his head rocking to and fro. It's not how I would have done it, but I'm not up there. I want to tell my father to mind how the stallion spooks to the right, how I think he sees better out of his left eye, but instead I say,
See you when it's over.
We nod to each other like strangers, the goodbye unpracticed and uncomfortable. I am watching the race from the cliffs when a grey Ishka horse seizes my father by his arm and then his chest. For one moment, the waves do not attack the shore and the gulls above us do not flap, and the gritty air in my lungs doesn't escape. Then the grey water horse tears my father from his uneasy place on the back of the red stallion. The grey cannot keep its ragged grip on my father's chest, and so my father falls to the sand, already ruined before the hooves get to him. He was in second place. So it takes a long minute before the rest of the horses have passed over the top of his body and I can see it again. By then, he is a long, black and scarlet smear, half submerged in the frothy tide. The red stallion circles, halfway to a hungry creature of the sea, but he does as I asked. He does not eat the thing that was my father. Instead, the stallion climbs back into the water. Nothing is as red as the sea that day. I don't think often on my father's body strung out through the reddening surf. Instead, I remember him as he was before the race, afraid. I won't make the same mistake.
Chapter 1. Puck. People say my brothers would be lost without me, but really, I'd be lost without them. Usually, if you ask someone on the island where they come from, they say something like, Roundabout Skarmouth, or Backside of Thisbe, the hard side, or stone's throw from Tola. But not me. I remember being small, clutching my father's lined hand, and some wind-beaten old farmer who looked like he'd been dug out of the sod, asking, Where you from, girl? I answered, in a voice too loud for my tiny freckled self, The Connolly House. He said, What's that now? And I replied back, Where we Connollys live, because I'm one. And then, I am still a bit embarrassed about this part of it, as it speaks to a black part of my character, I added, And you're not. That's just the way things are. There are the Connollys, and then there's the rest of the world. Though the rest of the world, when you live on Thisbe, is not very large. Before last fall, it was always this, me, my younger brother Finn, my older brother Gabe, and our parents. We were a pretty quiet family altogether. Finn was always putting things together and taking them back apart and saving any spare parts in a box under his bed. Gabe wasn't a huge conversationalist either. 6 years older than me, he saved his energy for growing. He was 6 feet tall by the age of 13. Our dad played the tin whistle when he was home, and our mother performed the miracle of the loaves and fishes every evening, though I didn't realize what a miracle it was until she wasn't around. It wasn't that we were unfriendly with the rest of the island, we were just friendlier with ourselves. Being a Connolly came first. That was the only rule. You could hurt all the feelings you liked, so long as you weren't hurting the feelings of a Connolly. It's midway through October now. Like all autumn days on the island, it begins cold, but warms and gains color as the sun rises. I get a curry comb and a brush, and I knock the dust out of Dove's dun hide until my fingers warm up. By the time I saddle her up, she's clean and I'm grubby. She is my mare and my best friend, and I keep waiting for something bad to happen to her because I love her too much. As I pull up her girth, Dove pushes her nose into my side, just shy of a nip, and pulls her head back quickly. She loves me too. I can't ride long. Soon I'll have to come back and help Finn make cookies for the local shops. I also paint teapots for the tourists, and since the races are coming up, I have more than enough orders backed up. After the races, there'll be no more visitors from the mainland until spring. The ocean is just too uncertain a thing when it's cold. Gabe will be out all day, working at the Skarmouth Hotel, getting the rooms ready for the race spectators. When you're an orphan on Thisbe, it's hard work making ends meet. I didn't actually realize there wasn't much to the island until a few years ago, when I started reading magazines. It doesn't feel it to me, but Thisbe's tiny. 4,000 people on a rocky crag jutting from the sea, hours from the mainland. It's all cliffs, and horses, and sheep, and one-track roads, winding past treeless fields to Skarmouth, the largest town on the island. The truth is, until you know any different, the island is enough. Actually, I know different, and it's still enough. So I am up and riding, my toes cold in my scruffy paddock boots, and Finn is sitting in the Morris in the drive, carefully applying black tape to a rip in the passenger seat. The rip was a gift from Puffin, the barn cat. At least Finn has now learned to never leave the windows rolled down. He's pretending to look annoyed with the repairs, but I can tell that he is actually cheerful to be doing it. It is against Finn's code to reveal too much happiness. When he sees me riding Dove, Finn gives me a funny look. Once upon a time, before last year, that funny look would have changed into a sly smile, and then he would have gunned the engine, and we would have raced. Me on Dove, him in the car, though he was technically too young to drive. A lot too young. It didn't matter, though. Who was going to stop us? So he would race, me through fields, him on the roads. First to the beach, had to make the other's bed for a week. But we haven't raced for nearly a year. Not since my parents died on the boat. I turned Dove away, making little circles in the side yard. She's eager and too brisk to concentrate this morning, and I'm too cold to make her soft and round on the bit. She wants to gallop. I hear the Morris's engine rev. I turn in time to see the car go tearing down the lane, accompanied by a puff of ill-advised exhaust. I hear Finn's whoop a moment later. He pokes his head out the window, face pale under his dusty hair, smiling a grin that shows every tooth he has. "Are you waiting for an invitation?" he calls. Then he retreats back into the cab, and the engine revs high as he shifts gears. "Oh, you're on!" I tell him, though he is far, far out of earshot. Dove's ears swivel back toward me, and then prick toward the road, quivering. It is a wild, cool morning, and she barely needs to be asked. I press my calves into her sides and cluck my tongue. Dove leaps into action, hooves digging up half circles of dirt behind her, and we tear after Finn. Finn's path is no mystery. He has to follow the roads, and there's only the main one, heading into Skarmouth past our house. It's not the straightest way, though. It winds around patchwork fields, protected by stone walls and hedges. There's no sense following his serpentine progress, marked by a trail of dust. Instead, Dove and I tear across the fields. Dove is not large. None of the natural island horses are, as the grass isn't great. But she's scopy and brave. So she and I throw ourselves over hedgerows at will, so long as the footing's good. We shave off the first corner, spooking several sheep. Sorry, I say to them over my shoulder. The next hedgerow comes up while I'm minding the sheep, and Dove has to twist herself in a hurry to launch herself over. I throw out reins in the world's worst release, but at least keep from jerking on her mouth, and she tucks her legs up tight beneath her and saves us both. As she canters away from the hedge, I gather up the reins again and pat her shoulder to show that I noticed her rescuing us, and she tips her ear back to show she appreciates that I cared. Then it's sailing across a field that used to hold sheep, but now holds scrubby heather waiting to be burned off. The Morris is still a little ahead of us, a dark shape in front of a tower of dust. I'm not worried about his lead. To get a car down to the beach, he'll have to either take the road through town, with its sharp right angles and crossing pedestrians, or make a detour around the town, losing several minutes and giving us a good chance to catch up. I hear the Morris hesitate at the roundabout and then zoom toward town. I can take the road around Skarmouth and avoid any more jumping. Or I can skirt through the very edge of the town, popping through a few back gardens and risking being seen by Gabe at the hotel. I can already imagine being the first to charge onto the beach. I decide to risk Gabe seeing me. It's been long enough since we did this that the stodgy old ladies can't complain too much about a horse passing through their yards, as long as I don't squash anything useful. Come on, Dove, I whisper. She charges across the road and through a break in a hedgerow. Here, there are houses looking like they grew out of the rock, and cluttered back gardens full of possessions that have spilled out of the houses, and on the other side of them, a stretch of solid stone that no horse should have to canter on. The only way across is to tear through a half dozen yards and pass the hotel on the other side. I hope that everyone's busily at work at the piers or in their kitchens. We burst through the gardens, half leaping over wheelbarrows in the first, avoiding a crop of herbs in the second, and getting barked at by an evil terrier in the third. Then, inexplicably, over an old, empty bathtub in the final yard, and we're off, down the road to the hotel. Of course, there is Gabe, and he sees me, instantly. He's sweeping the walk in front of the hotel with a mighty push-broom. The hotel is a forbidding, ivy-covered building behind him, the leaves cut in neat squares to let the sun into the windows, with their bright blue sills. The height of the hotel blocks the morning light, and casts a deeper blue shadow on the stone walk he sweeps. Gabe looks tall and grown up, with his brown jacket stretched across his broad shoulders. His ginger blonde hair creeps down the back of his neck, a little long, but he is still handsome. I feel a sudden surge of fierce pride that he is my brother. He stops what he's doing to lean on the end of the broom and watch me canter by on Dove. "Don't be mad!" I shout at him. A smile walks over one side of his face, but not the other. It almost looks like he's actually happy, if you've never seen one of his real ones. The sad thing is this. I've gotten used to this fake one. I become willing to wait for the real one to reappear, without realizing I should have been working hard to find it again. I canter on, urging Dove into a gallop once we're off the walk and back onto the grass. Here, the ground is soft and sandy and begins to slope rapidly, the track becoming narrow between the hills and dunes that lead to the beach. I can't tell if Finn is ahead of me or behind me. I have to draw Dove back down to a trot as the ground grows too steep. Finally, she makes the awkward leap that takes us down to sea level. When we round the final bank, I make a noise of irritation. The Morris is already parked where the grass meets the sand. The scent of exhaust hangs in the air, cupped by the rise of the ground around us. "You're still a good girl," I whisper to Dove. She is out of breath, but she blows out her lips. She considers it a good race. Finn stands half in and half out of the car, the driver's side door standing open his feet on the running board. One arm rests on the roof, and the other on the upper part of the open door. He is looking out toward the sea, but when Dove blows out her breath through her lips again, he looks back to me, shielding his eyes. I can see that his face is worried, so I nudge Dove next to the car. I let out the reins so that she can graze while we stand there, but she doesn't lower her head. Instead, she too turns her gaze toward the ocean, 100 yards ahead of us. What? I ask. I have a sick feeling in my stomach. I follow the line of his eyes. I can just see a grey head thrusting its way above the surf, so far away and so close to the colour of the tossed ocean that I can almost believe I'm imagining it. But Finn's eyes wouldn't be so large unless he was certain. Sure enough, the head emerges again, and this time I see dark nostrils glow so wide that I glimpse a tinge of red in them, even from here. Then the rest of the head follows, and the neck. Crimped mane pasted to its skin by salt water, and then the powerful shoulders, glistening and damp. The water horse surges from the ocean and gives a mighty leap, as if the final steps over the incoming tide are a huge obstacle to overcome. Finn flinches as the horse gallops down the beach toward us, and I lay a hand on his elbow, though my own heart is thumping in my ears. Don't move, I whisper. Don't move. Don't move. Don't move. I cling to what we've been told over and over, that the water horses love a moving target. They love the chase. I make a list of reasons it won't attack us. We're motionless. We're not near the water. We're next to the Morris, and the water horses despise iron. Sure enough, the water horse gallops past us without pause. I can see Finn swallowing, his Adam's apple bobbing in his skinny neck, and it's so true, it's so hard not to flinch until it's leapt back into the ocean once more. They're here again. This is what happens every fall. My parents didn't follow the races, but I know the shape of the story nonetheless. The closer it gets to November, the more horses the sea spits out. Those islanders who mean to race in future Scorpio races will often go out in great hunting parties to capture the fresh Kapil Ishka, which is always dangerous, since the horses are hungry and still sea mad. And once the new horses emerge, it's a signal to those who are racing in the current year's races to begin training the horses they caught the years before, horses that have been comparatively docile until the smell of the fall sea begins to call to the magic inside them. During the month of October until the 1st of November, the island becomes a map of safe areas and unsafe areas, because unless you're one of the riders, you don't want to be around when a Kapil Ishka goes crazy. Our parents tried hard to shield us from the realities of the Ishka horses, but it was impossible to avoid it. Friends would miss school because an Ishka horse had killed their dog overnight. Dad would have to drive around a ruined carcass on the way to Skarmouth, evidence of where a water horse and a land horse had gotten into a fight. The bells at St. Columbus would ring midday for the funeral of a fisherman caught unawares on the shore. Finn and I don't need to be told how dangerous the horses are. We know. We know it every day. Come on, I say to him. Staring out to sea, his thin arms bracing him upright, he looks very young. Just then, my little brother. Though he's really caught in that strange no-man's land between child and man. I feel the sudden urge to protect him from the grief that October is going to bring. But it isn't really the grief of this October I have to worry about. It's that of an October already long gone. Finn doesn't answer, just ducks back down into the Morris, and shuts the door without looking at me. It's already a bad day, and that's before Gabe gets home.
Chapter 2. Sean. Beach Grattan, the butcher's son, has just slaughtered a cow and is draining the blood into a bucket for me when I hear the news. We are standing in the yard behind the butcher's, the sound of our lack of conversation amplified by the echo of our footsteps on the stone around us. The day is beautiful and cool, and I'm restless, shifting from foot to foot. The stones beneath me are uneven, pushed up by roots from trees no longer in evidence, and stained too brown and black in dots and splatters and rivulets.
Beach, did you hear yet? The horses are out.
Thomas Grattan addresses his son, emerging from the open door of his shop. He had started into the courtyard, but pauses mid-stride when he sees me.
Sean Kendrick, I didn't realize you were here.
I don't say anything, and Beach grunts.
Came by when he heard I was slaughtering.
He gestures to the cow's corpse, which now hangs, decapitated and legless, from a tripod of wood. The grounds are awash with blood from where Beach was slow to place the bucket beneath the cow. The cow's head lies off to the edge of the yard, tumbled onto its side. Thomas Grattan's mouth works as if he'd like to say something to Beach about the scene, but he doesn't. Thisbe is an island well populated by sons disappointing their fathers.
Did you hear then, Kendrick?
Thomas Grattan asks.
Is that why you're here and not on a horse?
I am here because the new men that Malvern has hired to feed the horses are afraid at best, and incompetent at worst, and the hay has been poor and the cuts of meat even worse. There's been no blood to speak of for the Capel Ishka, as if by treating them as regular horses, the grooms hope to make them so. So I am here because I have to do things myself if I want them done properly. But I just say, I hadn't heard. Beach slaps the dead cow affably on the neck and tips the bucket this way and that. He doesn't look at his father.
Who did you hear from?
I don't really care about the answer to his question. It doesn't matter who heard or who saw what. Only that the Capel Ishka are climbing out of the sea. I can feel in my bones that it's true. So this is why I feel restless. This is why Cor paces before his stall door and why I can't sleep.
The Connolly kid saw one,
Thomas Grattan says. Beach makes a noise and slaps the cow again, more for emphasis than for any practical purpose. The Connolly story is one of the more pitiful ones Thisbe has on offer. Three children of a fisherman, orphaned twice over by the Capel Ishka. There are plenty of single mothers to be had on the island, their men gone missing in the night, stolen away by either a savage water horse or by the temptation of the mainland. Plenty of single fathers, too, wives snatched from the shore by suddenly present teeth, or seized by tourists with large wallets. But to lose both parents in one blow, that's unusual. My story, father cold in the ground, mother lost to the mainland, is common enough to have been forgotten long ago, which is fine by me. There are better things to be known for. Thomas Grattan watches soundlessly as Beach hands off the bucket to me and begins to indelicately butcher the corpse. It doesn't seem like there should be an artful way to butcher a cow, but there is, and this is not it. For several long moments, I watch Beach carve jagged lines, grunting to himself all the while. I think he may be trying to hum. I am mesmerized by the utter unawareness of the entire process, the childlike pleasure Beach takes in a job ill done. Thomas Grattan and I catch each other's eye.
He learned his butchering from his mother, not me,
Thomas Grattan tells me. I don't quite smile, but he seems gratified by my response anyway.
If you don't like how I do it,
Beach says, not looking up from his work,
I'd rather be at the pub, and this knife fits in your hand too.
Thomas Grattan makes a mighty sound that comes from somewhere between his nostrils and the top of his mouth. It is a sound that, to me, effectively proves the etymology of Beach's grunts. He turns away from Beach and looks at the red-tiled roof of one of the buildings flanking the courtyard.
So I expect you'll be riding in the race this year, he says.
Beach doesn't respond, because of course his father is speaking to me. I reply, I expect so. Thomas Grattan doesn't answer right away, just continues gazing at the evening sun lighting the roof tiles to brilliant orange-red. Eventually he says,
yes, I expect that's what Malvern asks of you, then.
I have worked in the Malvern yard since I was 10, and some people say that I got the job out of pity, but those people are wrong. The Malverns' livelihood and their name are under the roof of their stable. They export sport horses to the mainland, and they won't have anything compromising that, far less something as humanitarian as pity. I've been with the Malverns long enough to know that the Grattans do not care for them, and I know that Thomas Grattan wants me to say something that will allow him to better despise Benjamin Malvern. So I allow a long pause to diffuse the weight of his question, and then I say, with a rattle of the bucket handle, "If it's all right, I'll settle the account for this later this week." Thomas Grattan laughs softly.
"You are the oldest 19 I've ever met, Sean Kendrick."
I don't reply, because he is probably right. He tells me to settle the account this Friday as usual, and Beach gives me a parting grunt as I leave the courtyard with the blood. I need to be thinking about bringing the ponies in from the pasture and adjusting the thoroughbred's feed, and how I will keep my little flat above the stable warm tonight, but I am thinking of the news Thomas Grattan brought. I am here on firm ground, but part of me is already down on the beach, and my own blood is singing. I'm so, so alive.
Chapter 3. Puck. That night, Gabe breaks the only rule we have. I am unambitious with dinner, because we don't have anything other than dried beans, and I'm sick of beans. I make an apple cake and feel rather virtuous about it. Finn is annoying me by spending the afternoon in the yard, tinkering with an ancient broken chainsaw that he claims someone gave him, but that he probably pulled out of someone's rubbish because it had gears. I'm cross because I'm inside by myself, which makes me feel like I ought to be tidying, and I don't want to tidy. I slam around a lot of drawers and cupboards, while sort of messing over the eternally full sink. But Finn doesn't hear me, or pretends not to. Finally, before the sun completely vanishes over the high ground in the west, I throw open the side door and stand there looking at Finn meaningfully, waiting for him to look up and say something to me. He is all buckled over the top of the chainsaw, which lies dismembered in front of him. Pieces spread tidily over the packed dirt of the yard. He wears one of Gabe's sweaters that, while several years old, is still too large for him. He has the sleeves doubled back into fat, perfectly even cuffs, and his dark hair is mussed into an oily rooster tail. He looks like an orphan, and that makes me cross too. "Are you going to come in and eat the cake while it still remembers being warm?" I sound a little bratty. "But I don't care," Finn says without looking up. "In a minute!" He doesn't mean a minute, and I know it. "I'm going to eat it all myself," I say. He doesn't reply. He's lost in the mystery of the chainsaw. I think, just for that moment, that I hate brothers, because they never realize when something is important to you, and they only care about their own things. I'm about to say something that I might be embarrassed about later, when I see Gabe walking his bicycle through the dusk toward us. Neither of us says hi to him as he opens the yard gate, pushes his bicycle through, and closes it again. Finn, because he is self-involved, and me, because I am annoyed at Finn. Gabe puts his bicycle away in the little lean-to by the back of the house, and then comes to stand behind Finn. Gabe takes off his skullcap and holds it in his armpit, his arms crossed, wordlessly watching what Finn's doing. I'm not sure Gabe can actually tell what it is that Finn has eviscerated in the barely there blue light of evening. But Finn rocks the body of the chainsaw slightly to give Gabe a better view. This apparently tells Gabe everything he needs to know, because as Finn looks up, tilting his chin toward our older brother, Gabe just gives a little nod. The unspoken language both entrances and infuriates me. "There's apple cake," I say. "It's still warm." Gabe removes a skullcap from his armpit and turns to me.
"What's dinner?"
"Apple cake," Finn comments from the ground. "And chainsaw," I reply. "Finn made a lovely chainsaw to go with." Apple cake's fine, Gabe says. But he sounds tired. Puck, don't leave the door open. It's cold out here. I step back so that he can walk into the house. And as he does, I notice that he stinks of fish. I hate it when the Beringers have him cleaning fish. He makes the whole house smell. Gabe pauses in the door. I stare at him then, at the way he stands, his hand on the doorframe, his face turned toward his hand, as if he is studying his fingers or the chipped red paint beneath them. The way his face looks seems far away, like a stranger's, and I suddenly want to hug him like I used to when I was small. Finn, he says, his voice low. When you get that together, I need to talk to you and Kate. Finn looks up, his face startled. But Gabe is already gone, disappeared past me into the room he still shares with Finn, despite our parents' room being empty. Either Gabe's request or his use of my real name has gotten Finn's attention, in a way that my apple cake couldn't. And he begins to assemble the parts rapidly, dumping them into a battered cardboard box. I feel unsettled while I wait for Gabe to emerge from his room. The kitchen has turned into the small, yellow place that it becomes at night when the darkness outside presses it smaller. I hurriedly wash off three plates that match and cut a fat piece of apple cake for each of us, the biggest one for Gabe. Setting them out on the table, three lonely plates where once there would have been five, depresses me. So I busy myself making some mint tea to go with them. As I arrange and rearrange the teacups by our plates, it occurs to me, too late, that mint tea and apple cake might not go together. By then, Finn has begun the process of washing his hands, which can take centuries. Patiently and silently, he lathers his hands with the bar of milk soap, working between each finger and rubbing each line in his palm. He keeps doing it when Gabe emerges in fresh clothing, but still smelling of fish. This is nice, Gabe tells me as he pulls out his chair, and I'm relieved because nothing is wrong. Everything will be fine. Mint smells good after today. I try to think of what Mum or Dad would have said to him then. For some reason, our age difference feels like a massive void just now. I thought they had you getting the hotel ready today. They were short-handed at the pier, Gabe says. And Beringer knows I'm quicker than Joseph. Joseph is Beringer's son, too lazy to be quick at anything. Gabe told me once that we should be grateful for Joseph's inability to think of anything but himself, because it is why Gabe has a job. I'm not grateful at the moment, though, because Gabe smells like fish since Joseph is a feck. Gabe holds his tea but doesn't drink it. Finn is still washing. I sit down at my place. Gabe waits a few more beats and then says, Finn, enough, okay? Finn still takes another minute to rinse, but then he shuts off the tap and comes and sits across from me.
Do we still say grace if it's only apple cake?
And a chainsaw, I say.
God, thank you for this cake and Finn's chainsaw, Gabe says. Are you happy?
God or me, I ask.
God's always happy, Finn says. You're the one who needs pleasing.
This strikes me as incredibly untrue, but I refuse to rise to the bait. I look at Gabe, who's looking at his plate. I ask him, so what? Outside, I hear Dove wickering where the pasture meets the yard. She wants a handful of grain. Finn looks at Gabe, who's still looking at his plate, pressing his fingers into the top of the apple cake, as if he's checking the texture. I am suddenly aware of how tomorrow, the anniversary of our parents' deaths, has been looming inside me, and how it never occurred to me to think that it might be the same for quiet, solid Gabe. He doesn't lift his eyes. He simply says,
I'm leaving the island.
Finn keeps his gaze on Gabe.
What?
I can't speak. It's like he said it in a different language, and my brain has to translate it before I can understand it.
I'm leaving the island, Gabe tells us, and this time the statement is firmer, more real, though he still doesn't look at either of us.
Finn manages the whole sentence first.
What will we do with all of our things?
I add.
What about Dove?
Gabe says. I'm leaving the island.
Finn looks like Gabe has slapped him. I jut my chin out and try to get Gabe to meet my eyes.
You're going to go without us?
Then my mind provides an answer. A logical one, one that gives him an excuse. And I give it to him.
So you aren't going long, you're just going for...
I shake my head. I can't think of what he would be going for. Gabe finally lifts his face.
I'm moving away.
Across from me, Finn is clinging to the edge of the table, his fingertips pressed into the wood so that they're white on the very ends but bright red toward the joints. I don't think he's aware of it.
When?
I say.
2 weeks.
Puffin is mewling around his feet, rubbing her chin against his leg and chair. But Gabe doesn't look down or acknowledge her.
I promised Beringer I'd stay that long.
Beringer, I say.
You promised Beringer you'd stay that long? What about us? What's going to happen to us?
He won't look at me. I'm trying to imagine how we can survive with one less earning Connolly and one more empty bed.
You can't go, I say. You can't go so soon.
My pulse is clubbing inside my chest, and I have to press my jaw shut to keep my teeth from chattering. Gabe's face is utterly unchanged, and I know that I'm going to regret what I say. But it's the only thing I can think of, so I say it.
I'm riding in the races,
I tell him, just like that. Now I have both my brother's full attention, and my cheeks feel like I've been leaning over a hot stove.
Oh, come on, Kate, Gabe says, but his voice is not as sure as it should be.
He half believes me, despite himself. Before I say anything else, I have to think about it and decide if I believe me. I think of this morning, my hair tugged in the wind, the feel of Dove stretching out into a gallop. I think of the day after the races, the red-stained sand high up on the beach where the ocean has yet to reach. I think of the last boats leaving for the winter, and Gabe on one of them. I could do it, if it came to it.
I am. Didn't you hear in town? The horses are coming out. Training starts tomorrow.
I am so... so proud that my words sound firm. Gabe's mouth works, as if he is saying all sorts of things without passing his lips, and I know that he is going through all the counter-arguments in his head.
Part of me wants him to say, "You can't,"
so I can ask, "Why?" And he would have to realize that he can't answer.
"Because you might leave Finn by himself."
And he can't ask why. Because then he'd have to answer that question as well. I should be feeling very clever and pleased with myself, because it's very hard to render Gabe speechless. But mostly my heart is just going tip, tip, tip in my chest, very shallow and fast. And I'm half hoping that he'll say that if I don't ride, he'll stay. But finally he says,
"All right, I'll stay until after the races."
He looks cross.
"But no longer than that, or the boats will stop running till spring. This is a really stupid thing you're doing, Kate."
He's mad at me, but I don't care about that. All I care is that he's staying for a little while longer.
"Well, sounds like we'll need the money if I win,"
I say, trying to sound as adult and blasé as possible, but thinking that maybe if I do win the money, he won't have to leave. And then I get up from the table and put my plate and teacup in the sink, like it was a normal evening. Then I walk into my room, close the door, and put my pillow over my head, so no one will hear.
"Selfish bastard,"
I whisper. The words close under the pillowcase. Then I burst into tears.
Chapter 4. Sean. I am dreaming of the sea when they wake me. Actually, I'm dreaming of the night that I caught Cor, but I can hear the sea in my dream. There is an old wives' tale that Capel Ishka caught at night are faster and stronger, and so it is 3 in the morning, and I am crouching on a boulder at the base of the cliffs, several hundred feet from the sand beach. Above me, the sea has made an arch in the chalk, the ceiling 100 feet over my head, and the white walls hug me. It should be dark, hidden from the moon, but the ocean reflects light off the pale rock, and I can see just well enough not to stumble on the coarse, kelp-covered rocks on the floor. The stone beneath my feet has more in common with the sea floor than the shore, and I have to take care not to lose my footing on the slippery surface. I am listening. In the dark, in the cold, I am listening for a change in the sound of the ocean. The water is rising, quickly and silently. The tide is coming in, and in an hour, this incomplete cave will be full of seawater higher than my head. I am listening for the sound of a splash, for the rush of a hoof breaking the surface, for any hint that a Capel Ishka is emerging. Because by the time you hear a hoof click on the stones, you are dead. But there is nothing but the eerie silence of the sea. No seabirds at night, no shouts of boys on the shore, no distant hum of a boat's motor. The wind is ruthless as it finds me in the arch. Unbalanced by its sudden force, I slip and catch my balance again on the wall, my fingers splayed. I hurriedly pull my hand back. The walls of the arch are covered with blood-red jellies that wink and glisten at me by the light of the moon. My father told me they were completely harmless. I don't believe him. Nothing is completely harmless. Below me, the water creeps between the boulders as the tide comes in. My palm is bleeding. I hear a sound, like a kitten mewling, or a baby screaming, and I freeze. There are no kittens or babies here on the beach. There is only me and the horses. Brian Carroll has told me that when he is out at sea at night, he can sometimes hear the horses calling to each other under the water, and it sounds like whale song, or a widow wailing, or something chuckling. I look down to the water in the deepest cleft of the rocks below me. It has risen fast. How long have I been standing here? The boulders in front of me are already nothing but shiny humps of rock barely above the black water. I am empty-handed, but I am also out of time. I need to turn back and pick my way across the seaweed-slimed rocks while I still can. I look at my hand. A thick trickle of blood has welled in my palm and down between the two bones of my arm. It gathers, swells, drips soundlessly into the water. My palm will hurt later. I look at the water where my blood disappears. I am silent. The cave is silent. I turn around, and there is a horse. It is close enough to smell the briny odor of it, close enough to feel the warmth of its still wet skin, close enough to look into its eye and see its dilated square pupil. I smell blood on its breath, and then they wake me. It is Brian and Jonathan Carroll, and their faces both spell concern. Brian's face wears the traditional brand, furrowed eyebrows, lips puckered. Jonathan's comes out as an apologetic smile that changes shape every few seconds. Brian is my age, and I know him from the piers. We both deal with the water for our living, and so we have history together, though we are not friends. Jonathan is his brother, trailing Brian in every way, including brains.
Kendrick, says Brian. You up?
I am now. I lie there in my bunk like I'm tied to it and say nothing. Jonathan adds,
Sorry to wake you, mate.
You're the man, Brian says, though I'm feeling no kinship for him now in the middle of the night. I don't mind Brian. He says what he means.
There's nothing else for it. Mutt's in a world of trouble. He had a mind to wait up for one of the Capel to come out of the water. And now he's gotten what he asked for, and I don't think he likes it.
He's going to kill them, Jonathan says.
He looks pleased to have been able to state something so obvious before Brian could. Them, I echo. It's cold, and I'm wide awake.
Mutt and a bunch of his mates, Brian says. They're all in it, and they've got the cap all sort of caught, but they can't let it go and they can't bring it in.
Now I'm sitting. I don't have any love in the world for Mutt, also known as Matthew Malvern, the bastard son of my boss, or any of the grooms who scurry in submissive friendship behind him, but they can't leave a horse tangled up on the beach in whatever fool trap they've devised.
You're the one for the horses, Kendrick, Brian says. I reckon someone's going to get killed unless we fetch you back there.
Back there? Now I understand their expressions. They were part of this, and they know that I'll think less of them for it. I don't say anything else. Just get out of bed, pulling on my old sweater and snatching up my grease-black blue coat with all my things in its pockets. I jerk my chin toward the door, and they scurry before me like sandpipers, Jonathan wrenching the door open so that Brian can lead the way out of the stable. Outside, the wind is a live, starving thing. The sky over Skarmouth is a dull brown, lit by the streetlights, but everywhere else is inky. There is a bit of a moon, so it will be brighter by the ocean, but not much. We strike out across the fields, taking the straightest path to the beach. There's nothing out here but rocks and sheep, but it's easy enough to fall over either of them. Torch, I say, and Brian flicks on a flashlight and offers it to me. I shake my head. I'll need my hands free. Behind us, Jonathan jogs and trips, keeping up with our pace, making a beam of light arc crazily as his flashlight hand jerks. I'm reminded of my mother pretending to write words on the wall with a flashlight when the storm knocked out our power.
How far up the beach? I ask.
The tide will be coming in a few hours, and if they are around the point, a new Capel Ishka will be the least of their problems.
Not far,
pants Brian. He is not unfit, but strenuous activity tends to wind him. If not for their expressions earlier, I would have stopped to let him catch his breath. I can just see where the hills split and cleft for the path down to the sand. The land is a darker black against the sky, and then I hear a scream. The wind carries it to us, high and thin and ragged, and it is impossible to say whether it is human or animal. The hairs on the back of my neck prickle in a warning I ignore as I break into a run. Brian does not follow my lead. I don't think he can. And I sense that Jonathan is torn between staying with Brian and accompanying me.
I need the torch, Jonathan!
I shout back over my shoulder. The wind throws my words behind me, and though Jonathan replies, I can't hear him. I pelt out of the dim circle of his flashlight and into the darkness, stumbling and slipping down the steep descent to the beach. For a brief moment, I think I can't go forward any more because I cannot see, but then I step a few feet on and glimpse a knot of wildly moving flashlights down on the sand. Beyond them, I see the water dimly illuminated by the scant light of the moon. The wind is sucking the sound away from me, so as I approach the scene, it seems as if the men are voiceless. The struggle is almost artful until you get up to it. It's four men, and they've snagged a grey water horse around its neck and by the pastern on one of its hind legs, right above the hoof. They tug, and they jump back as the horse lunges and retreats. But they are in a bad place and they know it. They have the tiger by its tail and have just realized the tail is long enough for the claws to reach them.
Kendrick!
Shouts someone. I cannot tell who it is.
Where's Brian?
Sean Kendrick!
Shouts someone else. And this, I know, is Mutt, holding the line that leads to the horse's neck. I can tell by the shape of his silhouette. The broad shoulders and thick neck that is both neck and chin.
Who asked for that bastard to come? Go back to sleep, knacker. I've got this under control.
He controls the horse like a fishing boat controls the sea. I see now that the other line is held by Paget, an older man who should know better than to trust Mutt with his life. Next to me, I hear a soft sound in a moment between gusts of wind. I glance over, and there is another of Mutt's friends sitting against the rock wall where the cliffs meet the beach. He is curled around his own arms, and one of them he holds gingerly. It looks broken. The sound I heard was his whimper.
"Get out of this, Kendrick!"
Mutt calls. I cross my arms over my chest and wait. The horse has stopped struggling for the moment. Against the light chalk of the cliffs, I can see the trembling dark lines leading to the Capel Ishka. The horse is tiring, but so are the others. Mutt's muscled arms mimic the shaking of the lines. The other men creep around, laying loops of rope on the beach, hoping the horse will step into one. It would be easy, for someone who didn't know the water horses, to think that the Capel Ishka, standing there with its sides heaving, is defeated. And I see its head drawn back, predatory, raptor-like rather than equine, and know that things are about to get ugly.
"Mutt!"
I say. He doesn't even turn his head, but at least I said it. The line holding the horse's pastern suddenly stretches taut as the grey Capel lunges toward Mutt. I'm sprayed with sand and small pebbles from its hooves digging into the beach. Shouts punch the air. Paget reels and tugs on his line, working to off-center the horse. Mutt is too busy with his own welfare to return the favor. The line around its neck suddenly slack. The horse backs toward Paget. Its hooves drag circles in the sand, and then the horse is on Paget, teeth sunk into his shoulder, front legs reared up and embracing him. It seems impossible that Paget will not fall to the ground under the weight, but the horse's grip on his shoulder holds him upright for a brief moment before it falls to its knees, Paget tucked beneath its chest. Now Mutt is hauling the line around the horse's neck, but it's too little, too late. And what is he against one of the Capel Ishka? Paget is beginning to look improbable. Something about him is starting to look less like a man and more like meat. I hear plaintively from one of the men,
"Kendrick!"
I step forward, and right as I get to the horse, I spit on the fingers of my left hand and grab a handful of its mane and its pole right behind its ears. Pulling a red ribbon from the pocket of my jacket with my right hand, I press it over the bones of the horse's nose. It jerks, but my hand on its skull and neck is firm. I whisper in its ear and it staggers back, punching a hoof into Paget's body as it struggles to find its footing again. Paget is not my concern. My concern is that I have 2,000 pounds of wild animal being held by a string, and it has maimed 2 men already, and I need to get it away from the rest of them before I lose my tenuous grip.
"Don't you dare let that horse go!"
Mutt tells me.
"Not after all this. You bring it back to the stable. Don't let this be a waste."
I want to tell him that this is a water horse, not a dog, and that leading it inland away from the nearly November salt water is a trick I don't feel like performing at the moment. But I don't want to shout out loud and give the horse any more cause to remember that I am right next to it.
"Do what you need to do, Kendrick,"
yells Brian, who has finally made it down.
"Don't you dare let that horse go,"
Mutt shouts back. Just to get them all out alive would be a feat. Just to get the horse down to the shore and release it far enough into the ocean that we could get away safe would be impressive. But I can do more than just get them away safe, and they all know it. Mutt Malvern, most of all. But I whisper like the sea in the horse's ear and take a step back from the roving flashlights. One step away from all of them. One step toward the ocean. My sock wicks the tide into my boot. The grey horse is trembling under my hands. I turn to look at Mutt, and then I let the horse go.
Chapter 5. Puck. I don't think that I sleep, but I do, because in the morning my eyes are sticky, and my blankets look like a mole has tunneled through them. The sky outside the window is the blue of almost daylight, and I decide that no matter what time it is, I'm awake. I spend too long standing shivering in my sleeping top, the one with the straps of lace, that are just a little itchy, but that I wear anyway because Mum made it, staring at the contents of my dresser, trying to decide what to wear to the beach. I don't know if it will be cold after I've been riding for a while, and I don't know if I want to go down there dressed like a girl, when Joseph Beringer is probably going to be there looking at me like, huh, huh, huh.